my privilege to introduce Sandy.
Thank you. I just said the Serenity Prayer so I can be kind of focused here. Thank you, Paul. I'm very excited about being invited to come to your meeting. This is like one of the most famous meetings in Southern California. You all know that. This would have been a very attractive group for me early on. I'll tell you why in a little bit of time. You'll understand why. But yeah, you already understand, don't you? Yeah. Anyway, what I would like to tell you is that, again, thank you. I want to thank Paul for asking me to come and talk tonight. It's always an honor and a privilege. This is something I used to do a lot more often, and I guess because I just sort of put myself out there, and I enjoyed it at that time, and then I went for a real long time without being asked to talk, and that sort of put my ego back where it was supposed to be, you know. Because I certainly am not a circuit speaker, but I do have a program, and I have a spiritual program, and it's really an honor to be invited to share it. And I thank you so much for your kind attention and for just being the great meeting that you are. I want to first of all also thank my friend Terry for coming with me. I live in Claremont, so it was about a half-hour drive up with no traffic, and that was wonderful. We weren't sure how long it was going to take to come, and I was afraid I might be running a little late, but it was just perfect. I have been in Al-Anon this year. If I stick around until November, which I plan to do, it'll be 22 years. But I've got 21 years in Al-Anon today. That doesn't, I've heard people say, and I believe this is true, you know, it's not to impress you by any means, but it sure impresses me. And congratulations to the birthday boys tonight. That was so great. I think those early birthdays, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 especially, are the most special because I don't know about you guys, but I had a really, really hard time doing anything for myself consistently. And coming to meetings and working the steps on a consistent level, enough to take a cake in front of your peers is awesome, you know, and that's really showing how the program works, how God works, how sponsorship works, all those great examples of good stuff that we get to see. So how wonderful is that? And happy birthday to you guys. You are at the beginning, you're in the middle, no one's ever at the end, but we're going on our path, and it's a great path and beyond. This is the greatest place in the world to be. When I was brand new, I judged every single person in Al-Anon because I was beginning to kind of get an idea of my own personality, my own personal defects of character, as I've learned to call them now. And I just didn't think I had any problems, and I did not want to be with you people. And I judged you harshly. What I did was I judged myself out of a lot of recovery. My husband is the alcoholic in my life. I married an alcoholic. I was raised in a family that had the ism. I don't know if my parents were alcoholic or not, but they drank quite a bit. In fact, when my brother moved out of the home, they made his bedroom into a bar. But I don't judge them, or I don't know if they're alcoholic or not, but sometimes they act in certain ways. You might raise an eyebrow. I always like to say this, too. This has nothing to do with anything, but I just think it's a cool thing, and not a lot of people have ever done this. And so I also got, when I was 15 years old, I got to see the Beatles at the Hollywood Bowl. And then the next year, too. I don't remember the first year because I was screaming my head off. The second year was pretty cool because we heard them. But anyway, that's just a little aside, a little tidbit there. I was a crazy teenager. There are some really important rules that were handed out in my family. They didn't really say, these are the rules you must follow, but I sort of picked it up. I realized, you know, to get along, this is what I'm going to really need to do. And so one of those rules was, you never talk about what goes on inside our house with anyone outside, ever. And anytime I might say something to someone and I went over the line a little bit, I would get into very bad trouble and lectured to, you know, don't do that. I had another rule, which was don't make daddy mad. My father is a big, great big guy, businessman, executive, and he would seemingly always win the arguments. My mom, God bless her, did the best she could, but she had no program. And so we learned real quick not to make Daddy mad. Don't challenge him. Don't, you know, because otherwise he'll just be silent for 2 weeks or something like that. And that's worse. That gives you ulcers. I'd rather be having screaming, I think. Anyway, but those two roles basically stayed with me my entire life, and I'm shedding them now. I'm trying really hard to shed them. The big loud one always wins is still kind of a big thing in my head, but I know that there are places where it is safe to talk about what goes on in my home. When I was in college, I met my husband-to-be, and he was I lived in Palm Springs, and I was working at an irrigation company. And he comes in one day. He's the foreman out there who's putting irrigation systems together for all the new golf courses out in the desert, you know, like 38 years ago, 39 years ago. It's a long time. It's hard. It's funny when you think how long something's really, like a relationship's really lasted or hasn't lasted. You know, it's just like, how did I get to be this age? Because my brain is still way back there. But at any rate, whatever. I think that, but he was real attractive. He came into the office kind of looking like Johnny Cash, you know, in the hot desert and dressed all in black. And, you know, he came in from the desert and actually phone calls were coming in for him. I would give him the messages because I was the Girl Friday. And I never liked that name because I thought it was demeaning, but that's exactly what I was. I was the Girl Friday. I did those kinds of jobs. His landlord was having problems with him financially, apparently. And so I would answer the phone call. I'd give him the message. And he goes, you know, if you can get rid of this guy for me, then I'll take you out on an ice cream date on Friday. And I thought, whoa, that's pretty good. You know, and I figured, yeah. Because I didn't date a lot in high school. I had tons of friends. And, you know, I was in the drama group. And we all hung out together and stuff. But, you know, you always want that one-on-one magical thing, you know. And so this was pretty appealing. And so I got the guy, the landlord, off his back and, kind of, like, deflected the heat a little bit. And so we have our ice cream date. Now, I was 19 years old. I had been served once in a cocktail lounge. Not a bar, but a cocktail lounge in Palm Springs. So I knew where to go, where I could get served. After he said, why not forget the ice cream? You want to go have a drink? And I'm thinking, 19, great, let's go. So I knew where to go. And so I had something ridiculous, like Pim's Cup number 9, so that I could look older than myself that I was, or more sophisticated or something. Didn't particularly like it. Now, I tell that story because that's how I remember it. My husband remembers it a different way. He says, I was really glad that you went out, that you agreed to go out with me after I didn't show up that night of the first date. Now, I don't really remember that. And that doesn't matter because my husband, as I came to learn, was covered, decked out in red flags, warning signs, yellow blinking lights, many, many, many things like that. And so I think, now that's interesting. If that was really what happened, then why did I go out with him when he asked again? That's stupid. However, my thinking was a little distorted, and it just didn't seem like something I wanted to brush off. My husband drank a lot. He came from an alcoholic family. His father and all his male relatives, and a lot of the female ones too, were also alcoholics. But he was, he was going to take me away from all this. I thank goodness I finished my senior year in college. I got my degree, and then we got married right after. And I didn't pursue my graduate work because my graduate degree that I had really kind of wanted to do, because I thought, oh, I don't have to work. He'll just take care of me now forever and ever. And I thought that's what it was going to be. So he didn't actually, and I ended up going to work. He did the best he could. You know, I look at the things that we all grow up with. We all basically have the same story, really. Not specific incidences, but as a child, maybe our parents weren't available for us emotionally or even physically, and our hearts hurt. And we grow up with a hurting heart. And, you know, I know that every person in this room came in here with a heart that really hurt. You know, what's happened is that Al-Anon is such a wonderful healing program. The people here are so loving and so supportive that our hearts become healthy and that we can love and we can laugh again. And it's a wonderful thing. I think that what we get to learn in Al-Anon, too, is that the answers The first answer, of course, is God or a higher power. Work the steps. The 12 steps are placed in perfect order, in a perfect sequence, and they work. Each step leads us to the next. It opens the door and allows us to then face what's next. If I had not somehow gotten myself around to step one, I'll talk about that again in a few minutes, but if I hadn't somehow been able to accept step one, even though for me it was very hard, there is no way that I would have even stayed here. I would be in a sick relationship. So I want to move along because all the stories are similar. I have one or two that I tell just to sort of, maybe you'll identify with a little bit, so that you know I'm a real Al-Anon. I belong here. I believed that my husband was drinking. I didn't realize that he was an alcoholic, nor did I put the name to it for a long time. And I was getting angry at him because he wasn't showing up after work. He wasn't coming home. And by this time, we had a child, and you know, I had all my dreamy little ideals and expectations of having that child and what motherhood was going to be like and what it was going to be like with a family and a husband. You know, I didn't really grow up in the 50s, but I saw a lot of those TV shows, and so I sort of had an idea of what it was supposed to be like. So, but I'd get angry, you know, and I couldn't really talk to him about it. You know, your drinking bothers me because we can't make daddy mad. Big loud one wins. And so I would go on these safaris. The baby would be asleep, and I'd go, I know that son of a bitch has something somewhere. So I would attack the closet with a vengeance. Now, I got really, really, really good at feeling the coat pockets in the closet. I never wrinkled a thing. You never knew I was in there. But you can, like, put your hand in there and kind of go inside the lapels and feel it down and see, you know, what you can find. And I would do this all the time. There was never any privacy in my husband's closet. I did this all the time because I was looking for the thing that would tell me what it was. Tell me what's going on here. Now, I have a BA degree. I'm really pretty bright, I think. That gets me into trouble a lot. I know enough about a little, enough to get me into trouble. A friend called me the other day with a medical question. Don't ask me medical questions. I'll tell you what I think. I know enough to kill you. Don't ask me medical stuff. I almost killed somebody once prescribing. I'm not qualified. I have no degree, no license. Anyway, one day I found a bottle. It was a flask of early times bourbon, not to promote, but my husband had a favorite brand, which also might have been another one of those red flags. You know, buys the same thing all the time. That's what he liked. And so I was furious. I found that, and I kept looking for more. Like, I'm going to stockpile the evidence, and I'm going to get him tonight. Boy, he's going to get it. Although I reached in, and I found a plastic bag and another coat. And inside that little plastic bag were little white pills. And the little white pills had little X's across the top. Okay, so some heads are nodding. I knew what they were. I knew they were amphetamines because, to be honest with you, I told you I was in college, and I would use them myself, but just only for educational purposes. When I had to stay up all night, or it was a test, or I had to stay up 4 days, you know, 4 nights in a row reading 4 books for history, a class I never went to, and, you know, oh my God, I can't get less than an A because then, you know, daddy get mad or whatever, all that kind of baloney. But anyway, I knew what they were. And so I thought, this will really get him. So baby was asleep. I spread out the pills, and they are exactly the same size as the sweetener tablets I'm using for my coffee. Now, the cool thing about this was the sweetener tablets I was using had one line etched across the top. So all I had to do was take my little paring knife and cut the other direction so that we would have perfectly matched cross tops, you know, the slang for that particular drug. And I did that, and I flushed all the pills, the amphetamines, and I filled his bag with the little sweetener things, and some of them were broken in half, so I broke the same number in half in case he knew the contents and what it looked like. And so now that's the end of the story, because I forgot that it would be kind of cool to find out what happened when he took them. But of course he wasn't going to tell me. So, you know, that's a situation where somebody has this desperate feeling the low self-esteem that's starting, the desperate pain beginning, and so much anger, there's nowhere to put it. Don't know how to do it. And I never did hear what happened. So, you know, it was a disappointing story, but it was funny in the middle, right? I like to remember that because that was just me. I would just do stuff like that. As our marriage progressed, the disease of alcoholism became worse and worse, as it does. And I know that as I look back, I was being affected in a major way very quickly. It did not take long. You know, I started out what I thought was pretty normal, and then I started being dark, and I started being angry. I started being obsessed, you know, counting cars and, you know, sitting out on the porch and watching the cars go by. And, you know, a lot of people have great counting car stories, car counting stories. But, you know, I did all of that. And I was in my youth very artistic, musically and drawing and painting and writing and all those kinds of things. And I realized as I was getting more and more and more into the depths of this disease along with my husband that stopped. All of that totally stopped. I have lost every bit of creativity and artistic joy that I had because we had to focus on the alcoholic. He had to come home. By God, he had to come home. And if he didn't, whatever. One night, I was involved in a community service group. My parents were very, very active in their community and service clubs and things like that. And I got involved in a junior women's club when I was in my 20s. And that gave me a tremendous amount of self-esteem because my life was hell at home. My life was hell. If you were coming to my house Friday for coffee, I'd have to start picking up stuff and cleaning on Wednesday. I was chaotic. My brain was in chaos. I realized the way that my house looked, that was an extension of that chaos in my brain and my heart. And it was definitely embarrassing, and it affected our whole family the way that I was not able to cope with anything. So one night I'm going to my junior women's club meeting, and my husband comes home to babysit, and I knew it was going to be a hellacious night for the children. Because he gets home, he's already been drinking for quite a while. He goes and pulls the jug of wine out, sits it down in the living room, turns the stereo up loud, and it starts. And I believe probably most of the nights that I trusted him with the children, that was what it was like. Obviously, my part was I trusted an alcoholic to take care of the children who are vulnerable and, you know, precious and have no choice in their life. Now, I realized that this was going to be a problem, and I started to go out the door anyway because I got self-esteem from this group. I knew the police chief, the fire guys, you know, all of that kind of stuff. And as I'm going out the door, my little daughter, who's now probably 8 years old, is pulling on my leg saying, "Mommy, please don't go. I'm afraid of Daddy." But I pushed her back inside the house, closed the door, got in my car, and I went off to my community service meeting. And I don't like to tell that story very much because it makes me feel very sad that I wasn't a better mother to my children. And I believe very strongly our children don't get away without some sort of effect of growing up in an alcoholic home like ours was. My son is one of those still water runs deep kind of guys. He just goes inside himself, shuts it all off, and who knows what's going on in there. Today he's a practicing alcoholic. There's nothing I can do to help him except just let him know I love him. He lives nearby, so I get to see him from time to time, but I haven't seen him for over a week, and I see his van leaving every now and then, so I know he's alive and he's working. Our daughter suffered from all kinds of emotional problems, depression, eating disorder. We had this intervention with her eating disorder. She had bulimia. She probably still, I suppose it's like alcoholism. If you have a disorder like that, you always do, and you try your best to deal with it as you go. But she has bulimia. And we took her to a counselor at a hospital, hoping we would get her admitted. And the counselor said, "This is far worse than you ever can imagine." And that was pretty profound. That was like my stomach hit the floor, my heart broke. What do I do? What do we do now? And they didn't have the program at that time. So things like that happen in homes like our homes. And my heart sings when I see young moms in Al-Anon now, because they at least have a chance. You know, there's still probably going to be effects, but they have a chance to have a better life, those little ones. And for that, I'm so grateful. Anyway, my dad, well, I'll tell you about my first meeting. After about 16 years in this women's club, we had 16 years of marriage, we had a party. And I think I was president of the women's club. I was probably president of everything I joined. You know, I'm one of those types of people that sort of spot the leader, and that's the job I want. I even did that coming into Al-Anon. I thought, who's the president? You know, we come in the meeting, who's the president? And that's the job I want to have. And I admit I did that, and I figured out after a little while the convention chairs looked pretty important. And so I decided that would be a good job, and I ran for convention chair and didn't get it, and thought, well, maybe I'm supposed to wait around and learn a little bit more and have more experience. And so, but I've been convention chairman a couple of times, and it's a great gift, wonderful thing. Defects of character come out and play. Oh my God, I used to pray every single morning in the bathtub that I would not do anything stupid to get in the way of someone else's successful experience, whether it's a good one or a bad one. Don't let me get in their way, God, please. And that was my prayer every single morning, because I could tend to do that for you. I realize that that's not the point. But anyway, so we come home from this service club party where my husband has been falling off the furniture. He'd been drinking a lot, obviously, and I was embarrassed. I was so freaking embarrassed. I couldn't tell you. Angry, mad, but don't. The big loud one wins, so don't press it. So I got him in the car somehow, came home, poured him out, had the fight. And the fight that night was really a bad one. And I asked a rather fateful question. I said, are you an alcoholic? You know, in my nasty way. Are you an alcoholic? And he said, yes, I think I might be. And then that stopped me. I thought, oh my God, what am I supposed to do now? Oh my God. So what I did was I invited him to leave. I kicked him out is what it was. It's like, you know what? I'm done. I can't live like this anymore. You get out of here. We're done. We're finished. And you will never see the kids again unless you get some help. But we're done with you. And that was pretty awful. And I think I really meant it. And he did leave. And I thought everything was going to be all right. I thought everything was going to be okay. So he goes to a hospital program. Goes to a hospital program, and they start telling him things like, yes, you're an alcoholic. And he agreed he was an alcoholic. They told him to go to meetings. So he went to meetings. They told him to go to meetings in the community where you live. And so he did that. He started going to the 6:15 meeting in Covina, attitude adjustment meeting, and he met a bunch of great guys and great women. They told him that he needs to get a sponsor, and he got a sponsor. He started being he had a God in his life. There was creeping of God, and I'm thinking, well, that's okay. And he started being pretty attractive, I thought, at that point. But I went along to that hospital thing with him as well. I didn't want to look bad because they had a family program, and so I went as the dutiful wife to attend this. I even dragged the kids a few times because, by God, we're going to show up and we're going to look like we're all supporting this, but I can't wait till he's out of my life. That was my truth. And so they start talking to us. My answer was to all the people there, all the pre-Al-Anons there, kick them out. Life's better. I'm glad they didn't listen to me. So they told me I needed to go to Al-Anon. And I thought, God, I don't want to go to Al-Anon. It's not my problem. He's the alcoholic. He's in treatment. It's all going to be fine. Nope, you need to go to Al-Anon. So I didn't want to miss a certificate or any kind of like graduation thing I might get. So look bad like I failed, you know. So I call up the hotline. San Gabriel Valley had a hotline, Al-Anon. This lovely lady, I forget her name, but she answered the phone. And I said, I need to go to an Al-Anon meeting. And she said, well, great, sweetheart. Go Wednesday at noontime, if you can go at noon. I said I just had my lunch hour because I was so busy. My life was so busy, I could only squeeze it in during my lunch hour. And so there's one at noon at this pretty little church in Covina. And that's probably the best meeting for you to go to. So I said, thank you very much. And I put the phone down, and then I didn't go to that meeting on Wednesday. Went back to the support group, and they said, how was the Al-Anon meeting? And I said, I didn't go to the Al-Anon meeting. And they said, you know, you really need to go to an Al-Anon meeting. OK. I'm not going to get away with not going. I could tell right now. The peer pressure was really mounting. So I got on the phone and I called this hotline number again, and my God, it was the same person answering the phone. And I asked, I knew she was going to recognize my voice from the week before, you know, so I tried to disguise it a little bit, but I asked where the Al-Anon meeting was, and she said, you know, there's this wonderful meeting on Wednesday noon. And I thought, oh, damn it. And I better go, because if I call her again, she's going to really know it was me. So I was going to go with a friend from work, so I didn't have to go by myself, and her wires got crossed. I ended up going by myself to this meeting. Now, I wore my power business suit during that day because, you know, I'm just far too important, far too smart, far too anything to go to an Al-Anon meeting, but I'll give you a few minutes of my time. And so I was there in power clothes while people were there with knitting needles, and they were there with jeans on, and they didn't work. So I judged them, first of all, because, I mean, why don't you people have jobs? And then I saw somebody who had a gigantic Mercedes-Benz diamond pendant on, and I thought, oh, okay, she doesn't have to work, and boy, that looks pretty good. They've got jewelry in this program, so maybe this is okay to sit here. And they talked a little bit about God, which made me very uncomfortable. Seriously, it really did. And they talked about things like, my husband won't let me have the checkbook. Your husband. I sat there in my head. Your husband will let you have the checkbook. Give me a break. But, you know, now I stand here today having had my checkbook taken away a number of times since then, and so I have a deeper understanding. I'm not the most financially responsible person. I like to shop, and so sometimes that gets me into trouble. Someone else said her husband got drunk at a party, and she left him there. Oh, my God. You don't do that. I mean, I told you how I got my husband home that fateful night. We found out he was an alcoholic. You got to get him in the car, drag him in the house, pour him out. And so, you know, people were smiling and nodding. The other thing they talked about was why we don't give advice in Al-Anon. And I thought, that's the worst thing I can ever think of. Why in the hell am I here if you're not going to give me advice? What am I doing here? And I know today that that was the day's page. That was the topic on the One Day at a Time page for that day, which was in September sometime in 1984. Now, that wasn't my first meeting. These people were sweet. They were loving. They said the prayer. They held on, held hands, which kind of gave me the creeps as they prayed, you know, out, because I don't come from that. I just had a hard time with the spiritual aspect, the God aspect of this program. I had a difficult time. So, and I still do sometimes, I'll be honest and tell you that too. I struggle, but I continue to try to work. And they invited me back next week, and I thought that was very nice, and I smiled that smile, you know, that smile, that phony smile that we have sometimes coming in where we're not sure. And I said I'd be back. But, you know, it took two more years of living hell before I was really on, my ass was on the ground. I need, you know, something had to happen. My husband, God bless him, somehow stayed sober those 2 years, but our family, we had reconciled by that time. That's one of our on again, off again type things. So we had reconciled. Then it got bad. My thinking, my disease, my pre-Al-Anonism, that mental insanity, that insanity, was in full bore. Our children started acting out. It got to be very, very scary around our house. Quiet. Cold war. Nothing talked. Nobody talked. Silent. Like I said, I grew up like that, and that just gives your stomach ulcers. But that's what it was. And I thought, oh, my God, we cannot. Nobody deserves to live this way. And so I, like 2 years later in 1986, I made my phone call, not to the woman on the hotline. I didn't think she'd remember me after all that time, but I had someone directly in mind I wanted to call. We had met a lot of people through my husband's first 2 years of recovery. And I met this man who was going to Al-Anon meetings. And he was going to the Tuesday West Covina meeting where there's a big men's group. And I said, called him up, and I said, Galen, I think I'm ready to go to Al-Anon. I've tried everything in the world, nothing's working, and I don't know what to do, and our marriage is over, and I just don't know what to do. I said, but Galen, please, would you please, please, please take me to the meeting where the intelligent people go? And I knew today what I wanted to do. I really did, as I thought back now. I wanted to go to the men's staff meeting because they weren't going to be knitting. They weren't going to be whining. They weren't going to be talking about my husband won't let me have the checkbook. All that kind of stuff I judged I didn't look for any similarities. I looked for all the differences I could possibly find in that first meeting. So he takes me to this little room in West Covina. It's November, and it's cold, and it's raining. And I walk in like an ironing board, like, don't get near me. And I look around in this little tiny room with the rainbow painted on the wall. Very sweet little meeting. And I didn't see any men in there. And I thought, you have set me up. I was mad at him then. But I went, and they were loving. And they also had jewelry, which made me feel, you know, okay, it's all right to be here. But they laughed about stuff. They were laughing and cracking up about the most ridiculous things and the most painful things I could think of. But I committed to go to another meeting, and I went back, and I went back. And then a miracle happened to me in those that very first period of maybe 6 months to a year, before a year, actually 6 months. They had a weekend event, not unlike what you guys were talking about at the beginning of the meeting, that was going on. And my sponsor at the time, who was my husband's sponsor's wife, because I thought that's how you were supposed to do it, invited me to go. She assigned someone to pick me up because she knew I was probably going to not make it. You know, if it was up to my own devices, I'd find a way not to go. But I was picked up. I was taken to dinner. All these people are laughing and having a wonderful dinner together, and I'm just totally like a fish out of water. I just don't know what the heck's going on here. It was fun. They were nice to be around, nice people. We go to this religious or this spiritual place. Spiritual place, and something started happening to me. I was so shut down and inside and wrapped in concrete so protectively that people were greeting us by saying, "I hope you're healing." Oh, you know, then that was like a chink on the concrete. And, you know, I hope you're finding peace, and we're very glad you're here. And don't miss the miracle. And that was really pretty profound. And the Saturday, the speaker told a story in his talk. And he told a story about a family who owned a very expensive and precious, handed down from family to family, set of Waterford crystal. And they would use these beautiful goblets when they had special guests for dinner. And one night, one of the goblets was knocked off the table accidentally, and it broke. And it didn't shatter, but it did break into a number of pieces. So they were able to glue it back together again, and the mom would use the broken glass if they needed to complete the service of 12. And so one night they did, and the mom had the broken glass, and the guest of honor, she's hoping nobody notices, but the guest of honor points out her goblet, and he says, you know, there's something really, really beautiful about that goblet. There's something different about it than all the rest. The light shines through, the colors refract just a little differently. And I think that's the most beautiful glass I've ever seen. And then he said to us, and I know he was talking right to my heart, he said, and you Al-Anons, you have been broken by like that beautiful piece of Waterford crystal. And Al-Anon, the program of Al-Anon, is what is going to be able to glue your heart and soul back together again. And you are far more beautiful for that. And that's when it started for me. I believed that as my step to experience. I started to cry, and I hadn't cried for feeling in a long time. I could cry with anger, I could cry with disappointment, whatever, but there was just upwelling. And I didn't know what to do with that because I like to be in control, of course, and look good and all of that. But something happened. And I started sitting in our meetings and looking around. And I admitted I was powerless over alcohol. You know, I heard my husband share once at a conference that God is what got him sober. And I really probably held out some hope it was that I had something to do with it. So once I realized that wasn't going to happen, no credit there, I was powerless. My life was unmanageable. And what am I going to do with the steps that have God in it? Step two says a power greater than ourselves. And I'm pretty smart now, remember. And I knew that meant God. You weren't going to fool me by calling it a different name. And step three had the word God in it, actually said it. And there were others. And I thought, I can't be in this program. I can't do this because I do not have that foundation. I don't have a God of my understanding. I don't have anything. What happened was at that spiritual weekend, I was able to see the group, not unlike this one, the group. You guys said things I didn't understand. You said loving and kind things. You said healing things. A lot of you had a higher power, I could tell. And so I thought, maybe it's okay because step two doesn't say that I believe in God. It just says I believe that a higher power can restore me to sanity. All it is possibilities. And so I started placing that definition of higher power on the group, and for that I was very grateful because you didn't tell me I was doing it wrong. And so I heard, the other thing I heard at that weekend was, you never have to do anything alone as long as you live, unless you want to. And being a lonely person, one of those who's desperately lonely in a crowd, I held on to that too. This was my spiritual experience. This is how the program became a part of me. This is where God entered in, I believe. And today, I don't have a God that I use the word God because it's a generic term and we all know what that means. But inside me, I have a wonderful relationship with something that is comforting, some energy that is loving. It's probably feminine, but it's mine, and that's okay. Nobody is asked to understand anybody else's God. And that's what is one of the great secrets of this program. So I could have a beginning of a spirituality. And my third step was that, you know, I didn't know God. I didn't understand God. I had no idea. But it said that we made a decision to turn our will and lives over. And what I did was I kept coming to Al-Anon. I made a commitment to go to meetings. And my sponsor encouraged me to go to more meetings. And my sponsor, as far as I know, didn't really encourage me to work the steps. I don't remember being told that, except I just sort of had an epiphany last weekend I was sharing. And I realized that she was instrumental in my working the first three steps that opened the door for me. But then one day she invited me out for a drink and told me she wasn't coming to Al-Anon anymore. And I thought, okay. So I sponsored myself for a few months. And then I found my sponsor. My sponsor has been mine for 20 years now. KB in West Covina is my sponsor. And I liked what she had to say. We had similar things in common. Our children, our daughters are like 4 days apart in age. Now, I don't think that's necessarily really important that you get somebody who's got your story. But the key thing about, and I've learned about the things we have in common, what I really saw in my choosing my sponsor was that she walked like she talked. There was some sort of spirituality going through her, and it was she was very loving and welcoming. And after I asked her to be my sponsor, she said, yes, but have you started your inventory? No. Nobody ever told me about that. And so that was my first direction, my first assignment from a new sponsor 20 years ago. And I did my inventory, and I did it in a columnar fashion, which was good. I think had my sponsor said, why don't you just write an autobiographical sketch? I would have written The Great American Tragedy because, you know, drama queen, we do these things. But I had to get down to really the basic outline of my life, the causes, the conditions, the people. I had to own how I felt. And, you know, coming in here, I had no names for the feelings I had. But I started to realize how things affected me and how I would swallow them down and squish them down, and they would be, you know, they would be prevalent in my decisions and prevalent in the way I lived my life or raised my children. And that was an amazing thing. You know, it wasn't a really long, wasn't like a book, wasn't many, many, many pages, but it was what I needed to write at the time, and I was grateful for that. And she listened to my inventory, and when we were finished, she didn't say, I love you anyway. She just said, I love you. So I'm thinking, oh my God, this horrible person, I admitted all this stuff, all the self-pity, all the feelings I never was really allowed to feel, there it was. And I've had that good example of working the program ever since. You know, Covina is a pretty service-oriented, active area, and I'm grateful because it fits me to the T. You know, I like doing that stuff. I want to be on committees. I want to know how everything works. I want to be part of it all. I want to set the table and welcome you in. That's just sort of my nature. And I did that, and I started sponsoring people, and I was so grateful for that. The gifts, I figured out what everybody has said. You know, when someone calls you, you better pay attention to what you're saying to them, because that's your higher power speaking through you. In and of myself, I have nothing. But I kind of had a little ego involved. I was asked by 4 people, you know, maybe when I was 2 or 2.5 years in the program, 4 ladies all at once, and I'm thinking, maybe there's something about me that's starting to be attractive. My head was getting bigger and bigger. And then they all dropped me. Within short succession, I got fired 4 times. And I went to my sponsor and I said, you know what? I was angry. You know, it pissed me off. I gave you guys all this time. I listened to your inventory, blah, 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 blah. And you fire me? What is this? And so she told me, well, I think maybe there was a little bit too much you involved in that relationship and not enough God. That was a pretty important thing to be told. My sponsor loves me enough to tell me the truth. And so after a dry spell, then someone else asked me again, and I realized that it's nothing about me. I have nothing to give anyone besides what I learned here and the God speaking through our voices to one another and love. And it's been it's been on and off very, very good. It's been a good experience, all told. I told you I've been in 21 years, I think 8 years. I had divorced my husband after I was first new in Al-Anon in 1986. I did my inventory. I found out he wasn't the main problem. I had a part in it too. Fancy that. He started looking more attractive again, and so we started dating. And initially, I was thinking community property instantly. Oh, this is going to be fine. I'll go back and blah, blah, blah. But we had some struggles as we go. But we decided to remarry each other again. So he says I'm his second and third wife. He's my first and second husband. And I always say we were either doomed or we were destined to be together. And on any given day, I don't know which it is. But today... And I lost myself, you know, a few years later. I lost myself again. I became ill. I became overwhelmed. I was so busy in service. I had every position known to mankind in our meetings, in our district. I was a co-chairman for a convention. I was doing this, doing that, sponsoring maybe 25, 30 people. And my life was falling apart, and I couldn't understand why. And what happened was I lost myself again. I lost myself in all of that, whirling around as a convenient distraction not to look within myself. And so my husband and I, you know, of course no one deserves to live like that. My husband and I separated yet again. And we stayed that way for a number of years. And I was starting to really like living on my own. I really did. I'm good by myself. And my spices were not meddled with. They remained in alphabetical order for a long time. I got to have things my way in my house. But my daughter had moved in with me and her boyfriend at the time, fiancé, and her six-year-old son. And we started, she wanted to go back to school, and I was so glad about that because she was one of those who had a lot of trouble. And so they moved in, and she was going to go to school, and I was so happy. And, you know, I would have paid for everything. And in fact, I did pay for everything, as a matter of fact, but... Anyway, one day, right after we move in July, in August, my grandson is expressing that he's got some pain somewhere. And we really thought it was growing pains because it was sort of like in a joint or something like that. And they go to the doctor, and the doctor wants to check out some more stuff. And so they don't know what it is, but there's another appointment, which I was grateful that my husband and I went to this appointment. And what they found out was that Devin, my grandson, had cancer. And he had a kind of cancer that is a childhood cancer. We were hoping something like lymphoma or leukemia or something people do actually recover from. But he had stage 4 neuroblastoma. And I don't think they ever discover it in stage 1 through 3. The symptoms aren't there until... It's a tumor on the nervous system. Oftentimes it settles in the optic nerve and the children get blind, but most don't recover. And that was a pretty big kick in the gut. The day that he had his CAT scan and that the day of the diagnosis, he says to his mom, you know, we didn't pray this morning. And I thought, oh my gosh. The night before I was at my meeting and I said, you know, my grandson's going to have some medical stuff and I'm sure he's going to be okay. And then I thought, but what if he isn't? And it turned out that he wasn't. And so here goes another struggle with God. You know, this little boy fought for life with every fiber of his being. His last 6 months, he was playing Little League. You know, they let him play Little League. He was a little pitcher on the Pirates. You know, and that's what he wanted to do. He lived his life every single damn day that he could. And when he was 8 and a half, It became obvious that he was not going to be getting better, and they made the decision to stop the chemotherapy and just let it be. In the meantime, my daughter gets pregnant. She marries her boyfriend now, and so she's pregnant. And it turns out that the two events that are planning to happen, the birth and the passing, are almost on the same day. Okay. It got to be hard going to meetings. I'll say that. It got to be a little hard because people in their loving hearts were inquiring about how we all were. How's Devin? How's Devin? How's Leslie? How's Devin? And my daughter got to the point where she had been coming to meetings for about a year, and she wasn't able to continue, and she devoted her life to Devin and his care. And it got hard for me, too, to go to meetings. I thought, I can be the one who can tell how it's all going. And after a while, it got to be very heavy on me, too. And the night that Devin passed away, it was an amazing night. We were all there. My daughter realized that that was going to be probably coming up at that time. She had the baby on Monday, and this was on a Wednesday. This was happening. I'm sorry, she had the baby on... let me just, cute story. My grandson wanted to hang on. He knew he was very sick. He wanted to hang on, number one, to meet his brother, his little brother. And he also wanted to see the Harry Potter movie that was coming out at that time. And my dear friend David, who works in the industry, knew somebody at the production company and somebody in marketing, and they had all this Harry Potter stuff and the new video and everything. And so he got his two wishes. And it was becoming okay for him to relax and let go. There was music playing. He loved Fantasia, the Disney movie, so we had Fantasia music playing. And all of a sudden, I hear my daughter start to sing a lullaby that she used to sing to him every single night when he went to bed. And then she said quietly, "Devin passed away." And I never used to share that part of the story, but I realize how important it is for me that, number one, I could show up. Number two, my husband and I could be in the same room, and whatever differences we might have had, they were put aside at that moment. And we had all walked through this experience, and what happened when they took the body away, I went out to my car to go home, and of course we're all devastated, but I just sit in my car and I go, "What the fuck, God? What is all this? You know, how can this happen? How can this be?" I was so angry at God. And I put that on the shelf. You know, I stayed angry at God for a long, long time. And I don't have to understand God. The people in the program came for us in such a wonderful way. They came and they cleaned my refrigerator. They cleaned my lamps in the kitchen, you know, the ceiling fixtures that all the bugs get in, and you think I'm going to do it tomorrow, but there's bugs. They cleaned that out. They washed my windows. They would have cleaned my toilets if I asked them to. They were there. They showed up, and they did not leave. They let me have my time, but they were present, and I was so very grateful for that. I saw the loving hand of Al-Anon stretch out in a way that I had heard about, and for that I am so grateful. And, you know, I just want to talk about my higher power a little bit. The sad thing is, after my grandson died, his father, like 5 months later, took his own life because he couldn't stand to be without his son. And so that was a compounding other tragedy that, you know, we go through. And we've recently had a situation with one of our Al-Anon brothers where he took his life. And we think, you know, first we get angry, like, "You son of a bitch, you didn't realize how many people love you." You know, angry. And, you know, so it's a sad thing when that happens. And there's no understanding and there's no answer to any of the questions, except just there was an amount of pain that was insurmountable, I guess, in that person. But what happened for me was, I thought, you know what, I seriously wanted just to take Jonestown Kool-Aid. Any of you older left to know, remember about the sect in Guyana who took poison Kool-Aid and all the people died. Mass suicide. That's kind of the way I wanted to go. I just realized I can't face the feelings that we're going to be facing. It's going to be too much. I can't do it. And then I had another thought after that. And what happened was I thought, you know, my little grandson fought for life so hard that it meant something to him. And I can throw my life away, or I can go sail away in the sunset, or I can do something that would be an homage to him. And I thought, what was I doing when I was feeling better, when things were going well? And the answer was, I was of service. So after I had my burnout and I had given up all my service commitments, just because I was doing them all poorly, I thought, okay, that's the answer. God spoke through us at that time, and the answer was be of service. And so there was an opening in our district for an alternate district rep, and I volunteered to do that, and then I was a district rep. And I've really found my home and where I'm the most energized right now, aside from my own meetings, but in world service, and I've been very privileged to serve Southern California in that way, and I'm very, very honored about that. But that brought me back to life. My grandson's experience threw me back into service, and I can't tell you enough how important that is. Now, I know it's time to stop, but I have two opinions. One of them is that the most important job, maybe it's just one opinion, but the most important job in an Al-Anon meeting is not the secretary, it's not the speaker, it's not anybody other than perhaps the greeters. So those guys of you guys who are greeters, thank you very much for doing an amazing job. That's an important one. And the literature person, and the coffee maker, because I knew when I went into an Al-Anon meeting, I didn't want to be there. I didn't come in saying, let's go do Al-Anon today. And the first person I saw was the greeter. And even though it gave me, you know, it was kind of weird to hug somebody I don't know, I came in and I was invited in. But let's just say the greeter. And then somebody who's scared to death might just go put their head in the library, look at the literature where you don't have to talk to anybody, or go get a cup of coffee and sit down. But those people who do those services, and the one who opens the door, the secretary too. But I believe those are the most important jobs. So all the rest is just a wonderful benefit. But I'm here today to tell you that my relationship with my higher power is improving. I had to just sort of believe that I had a relationship with a higher power for a long time, because I just really had sort of a spiritual break. And this last weekend, I was asked to be the spiritual speaker at a conference. Spiritual speaker, that's a big, heavy title there. And I thought, they've picked the wrong person. But you know what? I had an experience there that let me know that it doesn't have to be perfect. But all I need to do is work on a regular basis, to work step 11, to practice these principles in all our affairs, as step 12 tells us, and to show up. And so for all of you who are here today showing up for the newcomers, and I want to welcome the newcomers with all my heart, please come back. Do not judge anybody. Don't judge yourself out of a meeting, because we're just all really, our hearts are all the same. I wrote a thank you note to the chairperson of the convention, and God, through me, somehow wrote this very clever thing that said, the language of the heart was spoken fluently this weekend. And I say the same thing about our meeting tonight. Thank you so much for letting me share.